Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Interviewing somebody who is in a submarine at the bottom of the ocean, the Gulf of Mexico to be exact, takes a bit of preparation.
I'm going to give you a little heads up on how this is going to work, okay?
Okay. First, I talk to the expedition leader.
It's a one-way conversation each way. So you're going to ask your question or talk to them, and then you're going to follow with the word over, just like old school radio.
And then he patched me through to marine biologist Eric Cordes, who was about 1,600 feet underwater.
So we're sitting in front of what I would describe as a coral garden. We see some crabs crawling around, looking for little bits of food.
This expedition happened in 2014, but I've talked to Eric several times since then about his work. He studies deep sea corals. The submersible he was on that day is called the Alvin.
So it's a thick titanium sphere with these big, thick windows that you can see out of.
The journey to the bottom of the ocean begins with sealing the doors and then lowering the submersible into the water.
And you're rocking around a little bit. You can feel the waves moving. You finish all your safety checks, and then they give you permission to dive. And then as soon as you get below the surface, all that motion goes away. And it's still and it's quiet, and you're slowly sinking down. Everything gets darker and darker around you as you descend.
And after a few more hundred feet, everything goes pitch black.
And everything that you bump into on the way down glows. It causes this bioluminescent reaction and this greenish light comes up. And so you can stare out the window and see all these little tiny organisms like stars slipping past the windows. It's really just a beautiful experience.
The submersible collects samples that are then brought back up to the surface to be studied. And Eric says he's already learned a lot from these excursions.
We found these deep water corals. It's called Lophelia, is the name of the species. It forms large reefs, these beautiful coral reefs, just like you would see in shallow water. But they're down hundreds of meters where there's no light and they're totally cut off from photosynthetic productivity. They're reliant on everything raining down from the surface. But what we found in our previous studies was that these deep water coral reefs are surviving at lower pH values than any other reefs on Earth. And what we're going out to see if we can discover is how they're doing that. What is it that allows them to survive under these incredibly harsh conditions that shallow water corals would die under? And if we can figure out how they're doing that, how they're able to still calcify and lay down their skeleton and survive under this ocean acidification, we might be able to find some key to being able to save some of the shallow water coral reefs, to see if maybe some of the shallow water corals could adapt to ocean acidification and survive the way that Lophelia is surviving.
So much of what's down there is still unexplored.
So many of the species that we find are undescribed and never seen before. Every time I go in a submarine to the bottom of the ocean, I see something that I've never seen before, and a lot of times that no one has ever seen before. And that's really an amazing feeling.
Scientists are unlocking some of the secrets of the deep sea, the creatures that live there, the ecosystems that thrive without any sunlight. On today's episode, lessons from the deepest parts of the ocean and the mysteries we're finding there. Science writer Sabrina Imbler grew up in the Bay Area in California and developed a love for the ocean, playing in tide pools or going snorkeling.
I was a child who was ready to love the natural world, but I also had a very severe grass allergy, so I couldn't really be in the forest or, you know, do a hike because I would just be sneezing constantly. And so I feel like the ocean, it was like a place where I wouldn't sneeze. And it felt so, so different than anything I saw on land. And I think in those moments, I really cemented my connection with the ocean and have since just found it an immensely fascinating place.
Sabrina recently published a book of essays. It's called How Far the Light Reaches, A Life in 10 Sea Creatures. It can seem like an inhospitable place, especially the deeper we go down. It's cold, it's dark, it's, you know, not conducive to life as we know it on the surface. But what do you find so beautiful about the creatures that kind of manage to carve out an existence there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good word you use, inhospitable. It's one that I think about a lot as a science journalist, because I feel like whenever we write about a new creature that's kind of weird, you know, we'll say, you know, it finds a way to live in the most inhospitable place. And I always try to remember that that is like our own human frame, right? Yes. Something that is inhospitable for us is like quite hospitable for everything that's living there. And I mean, I feel like I learned that even when I was snorkeling, right? Like, you know, the water was warm and the fish were colorful and the waves were not too strong, but still I was, you know, a human holding my breath with my little snorkel as an apparatus, like to help me live there. And all these fish were doing fine. And so, you know, I don't see, you know, like the bright tropical waters of a coral reef like any differently than I do the deep sea, where I absolutely couldn't go without, you know, being inside a very big submersible. But everything there, you know, has evolved to adapt and survive in its particular ecological niche. And I find that really fascinating.
After graduating from college, Sabrina took a job writing for an ocean nonprofit, putting out what they say was essentially clickbait for ocean lovers.
Stories like, you'll never guess where they found this seal, or whales do what with their blowhole.
They wrote about all kinds of sea creatures, but one story really had an impact on Sabrina.
This deep sea octopus in Monterey Canyon off the coast of California, who scientists discovered brooded her eggs for 4.5 years without eating.
Scientists had discovered this octopus during a routine survey of the underwater cliffs.
They'll just send, you know, a submersible down and sort of just observe the cliffs. And they saw this octopus that was sort of moving toward the cliff. And she is a species called Granuledini boreopacifica. And then they returned to the same site a little bit later and saw that she had latched on to the side of the cliff. And at this time, she was purple. She had, you know, nubbly skin, as is characteristic of her species of octopus. And then they just kept on returning to the site to sort of check up on her, because, you know, it's a lot of the behavior of animals that live in the deep sea is unknowable to us, right? We can send our submersibles down, but we can only really be there for a couple of hours. So any chance we have to sort of observe the behavior of a creature over time is really special. So they kept sending the submersible down, and each time they returned, they noticed that she was paler, that her skin had grown flabbier, right? Because she wasn't eating for this entire duration of her ordeal. And in one visit, they actually tried to feed the octopus with, I think, like a bit of crab that they offered her with the submersible arm. And she refused to eat, which felt like a very clear indication that, you know, if she wasn't taking this food that was right next to her, like she was not leaving her eggs to hunt on her own. And each time they returned, you know, she was paler, she was whiter, she seemed a little bit more haggard. And then at the end of the 4.5 years, they returned and they saw that the octopus had gone and all of the little eggs that she had been sitting on, they had all ruptured, meaning that they had hatched.
And it takes that long for the eggs to hatch?
Yeah, I mean, every octopus species is different. Some, you know, it just takes a couple of months, but this was remarkable to the scientists, right? That both of the eggs took 4.5 years to hatch, but also that the octopus sat on them for 4.5 years. And they noticed that the eggs were quite large for deep sea octopuses, which I think is part of, you know, the reason you would sit on your eggs for 4.5 years. Like, you really allow them a chance to grow, a chance to hatch as the most mature version of the baby as possible.
After the eggs hatched, the female octopus disappeared. What happened to her?
So she died. I mean, they didn't see her die, but all octopus mothers, after their eggs hatch, they all die. There is a gland actually inside female octopuses that basically sort of can trigger a death spiral, like after the eggs are released, where the octopus mother will sort of destroy herself either by like eating herself or like smashing herself against a wall. It's very dark, but that's just sort of how the octopus life cycle goes. A male dies soon after mating and a female octopus dies right after the eggs are laid.
Is there any sort of guess why it's set up that way? It doesn't, I mean, it seems kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know. Maybe it's so that she doesn't eat, you know, her young. I know I've had fish tanks before, and I had a pregnant fish once. Most fish lay eggs, but I had a live bearing fish, and I was so excited for all of the babies to come out. And then I like came home from school one day, and she had eaten them all, and I was so sad. Maybe it's something like that, but I don't know if scientists know the precise reason.
It's really hard not to anthropomorphize this octopus as she's sitting there waiting for these eggs to hatch, just like waiting for her own death. And one can't help but wonder, does she know? Is she just like stoically sitting there? So how did you handle this desire to want to understand what is happening? And yet we know we can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I absolutely wondered, you know, does she know that after this she will die? Like, did she know that before she mated? Did she know that, like, you know, when she sat, did she see other mother octopuses in the deep sea, sort of like on these little cliffside vigils? And yeah, we don't know. But I think the way that I tried to approach it was just to be as curious as I could about the octopus's individual experience, right? And I don't know what an octopus thinks of death. I don't know if it understands it, but I did want to know, you know, what is it like to sit on a cliff and have only one vista for the rest of your life? Like, what do you see? What passes by? How does your body change? So trying to understand the octopus on her own terms, and then sort of like thinking internally about what her vigil meant to me.
Sabrina uses the experiences of different sea creatures to reflect on things that have happened in their life and draws parallels. Another creature they write about is the hairy-chested Yeti crab.
So I learned about the hairy-chested Yeti crab originally in a meme.
This was in 2016. Sabrina had recently moved to Seattle and felt really sad and lonely there.
I saw this still from a nature documentary of a little white crab, you know, clinging to a rock in what appeared to be the deep sea. Like, it was very dark everywhere else, and the crab looked weird, which feels like a good marker of the deep sea. And at the bottom of the image, there was this caption: "This creature has adapted to the crushing pressure and oppressive darkness." And I looked at this crab and I was like, I can relate. Like, I just moved to this new city. It's so rainy. It's so cold. I don't really know many people. Like, the sun barely comes out. And I saw this crab and I was like, I have to be this crab. I have to adapt. I have to get used to this and, you know, be able to find light somehow. This crab in particular lives around hydrothermal vents, which are parts of the oceanic floor where sort of seawater trickles into porous rocks and then is heated by the magma underneath and then surges back up again, you know, in this heated mixture of water and chemicals in vents in the seafloor. And, you know, most of the deep sea, it's like the temperature is around freezing, but around these hydrothermal vents, the water is actually quite like warm. It feels mm-hmm. often like a kiddie pool around these vents. And so a lot of life is able to sort of live in these heated oases on the seafloor. And, you know, these vents actually precipitate chemicals out of the openings in the seafloor, which a lot of organisms depend on for life, the way that a lot of trees on land, you know, use photosynthesis. Organisms around these hydrothermal vents use chemosynthesis and change the chemical reactions in a process to convert energy in these gases into food.
Yeah, what do they eat down there?
So, I mean, sometimes they eat each other. Oh. that's true of everything. I guess, like, yeah, that's one truism of Earth. But this one particular species of Yeti crab called Kiwa puravida, it clings to the rocks around these hydrothermal vents, and they swing their claws like back and forth. And scientists, when they first saw this Yeti crab sort of dancing, right, like swinging its claws back and forth, they were so puzzled. They were like, why is this crab expending unnecessary energy? It's so hard to live in the deep sea. There is so little food. But then once they brought a crab back up on land, they realized the crab's claws team with chemosynthetic bacteria. So basically, these tiny organisms live on the crab's claws that can extract food from the chemicals of the vents. And so when the crabs were dancing, they were basically farming the bacteria on their claws, sort of waving them back and forth to bring them fresh oxygen and fresh sulfides, kind of like farming their own food. So the crabs, you know, are basically growing this bacteria on their claws, and then they just eat the bacteria.
And I would imagine that the temperatures could fluctuate and perhaps sometimes fluctuate, you know, kind of quickly from pretty hot to pretty cold, depending on where on the vent you are or whether you get like swept to the side or something. So do they have to navigate that at all, or have they become really good at just like finding the sweet spot where it's comfortable?
I mean, that's a great question, right? Because the water's directly out of the vents, like they can reach 700 degrees Fahrenheit. Ooh. Like it is so hot. And then the waters surrounding the vents are freezing cold, like just above freezing. And so there is this halo of safety where the crabs need to congregate, where it is kind of the temperature of a kiddie pool. And so they all just pack up on top of each other and basically like crawl on top of each other. If you see a photo of the vents, the crabs look almost like snow, like that's how close together they are on the rocks, because this is really the only place that they can live. But they don't seem to mind living in such close quarters, right? They're all farming their bacterial claws. So they just all stack up on one another in a very, very tight, cramped conditions.
So it's like a commune of sorts.
Yeah, like a commune.
And what were the kind of parallels you drew from this crab? I mean, obviously you said you were feeling the pressure, you were feeling alone, you felt the need to survive in a strange environment. But what were some of the other things that you took away from this crab?
Yeah, well, so the first image of the crab that I saw, right, it was just one crab sitting on a rock, and this crab had adapted to the crushing pressure and oppressive darkness, and that felt very lonely. But then when I saw all of these crabs just like swarming together around these hydrothermal vents, you know, it didn't feel very lonely. It felt very cramped, but it felt fun. And the first thing I thought when I saw these crabs together is I thought of like, the only capacity in which I'm so close to other people is like when I'm on a dance floor, when I'm at a club, you know, packed in into a tiny sweaty room, and like you're bumping elbows with someone, like it's not comfortable, right? But it's joyful. It has its own kind of joy. And, you know, that the parallel became a lot clearer when a couple of months into living in Seattle, I began to find, you know, outlets of joy and like places felt like I was among community and where I could, you know, forget about everything else for moments. And those were in queer nightlife spaces. There was this one party called Night Crush for queer people of color and trans people of color that really became like this beacon for me. It would happen every month and I would look forward to it so much. And I would just dance all night and I really felt held and I felt safe in these spaces. And, you know, I began to realize like, you know, all the crabs, you know, they gather around these vents because like, here is where the temperature is safe enough to live. Here, you know, are where these life-giving chemicals are gushing. And it felt very similar for me. Like I'm in this space, this queer club that is helping me sustain myself throughout this like otherwise harsh and cold winter.
That's science writer Sabrina Imbler. Their new book is called How Far the Light Reaches, A Life in 10 Sea Creatures. The depths of the ocean are filled with exquisite and awe-inspiring creatures. Brilliantly colored shrimp, octopuses that glow in the dark, luminescent jellyfish that look like angels. And then there's the sand striker. Science writer Sabrina Imbler told me about this strange creature.
So the sand striker is a worm. It's a polychaete worm, and they live basically burrowed into the seafloor. So if you were to be like in the ocean, you probably would never really see the whole worm because its body, which can grow like 9-10 feet long, is basically just deep within the sand. And they have these antenna and these like big jaws that basically sort of poke out of the sand, and they sense for prey like that. They sort of have their antenna swiveling, they have their jaws open, and then whenever an unsuspecting fish comes too close, the sand striker closes its jaws around the fish and drags it down into its burrow.
It sounds like something out of a horror movie, but Sabrina is a fan.
I'm of the opinion that any animal can be beautiful in their own way. And the sand striker, if you do get a chance to see a photo of it a little bit outside of its burrow, like it is beautiful. The skeleton is iridescent and so takes on this rainbow sheen in the light, like these beautiful electric blues and purples and oranges.
But for aquarium owner Don Arndt, the sand striker, which is also known as the bobbit worm, has very few appealing qualities.
I more likened it to the sand creatures in Dune. It's quite disgusting.
Don became a bit of an expert on this worm by accident. He loves all things ocean. He grew up in Southern California, and he's been a scuba diver since he was a kid. He lives in Michigan now, and to bring some of that ocean vibe with him, he set up a giant saltwater aquarium.
It's a way for me in Michigan to experience a tropical reef anytime I want to. It's very relaxing. It's just like scuba diving.
And Don is very serious about his aquarium. He didn't just want something pretty to look at. He wanted a genuine ecosystem. So in 1996, he did something a lot of home aquarium enthusiasts were doing at the time. He bought a special massive rock for his tank.
People put rocks out in the ocean and they get colonized by various organisms, and then they sell it off to aquarium owners as live rock.
Live rock introduces a diversity of bacteria, algae, and tiny creatures into saltwater tanks that help create healthier ecosystems and filter the water. In Don's case, the rock also brought something else, a sand striker, the bobbit worm. The long and arduous battle that ensued is reminiscent of fighting an ancient mythical sea monster. Liz Tung has more.
The first thing to know about Don is that he's a total aquarium nerd. He started keeping fish when he was just a kid.
And I've always had one ever since, much to my wife's dismay.
Don has a saltwater aquarium, which is a ton of work. Picture a real-life version of the Little Mermaid. Gorgeous coral, brightly colored tropical fish. It is exquisite. And for almost 30 years, it's been a big part of Don's life, not to mention his house.
So it's a 150-gallon saltwater reef tank. And it's 4 feet wide, 2 feet deep, and then just about 3 feet tall.
In other words, it's huge. The aquarium's technically located in Don's garage, but he cut a hole in the wall between his garage and his house, so it looks like a picture hanging on the wall. And for all this time, it's been a source of beauty and relaxation for Don. Until one fateful night in 2009, when Don spotted something strange.
One of my corals, something bit a big hole in it and scurried off into the rocks. And that's how this whole nightmare started.
At the time, not many people knew about bobbit worms, but what they'd heard was bad. For one thing, they're hideous.
So a bobbit worm looks like a giant centipede. It's got these tentacles that stick out and it's kind of multicolored.
They grow incredibly fast and incredibly big.
They can grow to 11 feet long. This particular one that I had was about 3/4 of an inch around.
About the diameter of a quarter. They're also ambush predators. They burrow into the sand and then shoot out with razor-sharp jaws capable of slicing fish in half.
And the thing could disappear in a fraction of a second. They're so fast.
Worst of all, they're destructive.
They literally eat everything. I observed him one night eating stony coral, which is basically calcium, like an ear of corn. He was just chewing it right off. They eat fish. They eat everything.
One of the things that was most disturbing to Don is that the worm had probably been living in his tank for more than 10 years by the time he noticed it. Don's guessing it rode its way into the tank in the live rock that he'd installed in his aquarium back in 1996. Which means it was probably just a little baby worm when it first arrived. 13 years later, Don was guessing it had grown to around 2 to 3 feet, all of which it was able to hide, slinky-like, in a one-inch hole in the aquarium's live rock.
It literally was like all through the rocks. It tunnels through rocks. It literally can eat rock, which is amazing.
Don had no idea how to get this thing out of the rock it was living in. And there was no way to get the rock out of the aquarium. It weighed 90 pounds dry. Soaked with water and covered in coral, Don says it probably weighed almost 300 pounds. Plus, it had become an integral part of the tank's ecosystem.
There's just no way to get it out without totally destroying the whole aquarium.
No one else Don talked to knew what to do either. So instead, Don turned to an ancient tome of wisdom.
The Art of War.
That's right, the famous military treatise written in 5th century BC by Sun Tzu. Source of the famous quote, "Keep your friends close and your enemies closer." So Don decided he would start off by befriending the bobbit worm.
So I started feeding it every night. They're nocturnal mostly. And I would stay up all night waiting for it to stick its little head out. And then I would feed it shrimp. And so it got used to coming out every single night at the same time. And I would feed it every night at the same time. And then I started the war.
Don's first plan of attack was a plot worthy of a Shakespearean drama. He would poison the worm.
So my first plan was, once I got it eating shrimp, I would inject the shrimp with copper, which is poison to most aquatic animals, and then feed it a copper-laden shrimp, and then hopefully it would die.
And so, okay, so you would lower the shrimp down with tongs. It would, like, shoot out and get the shrimp. And then it ate the shrimp with a copper in it, obviously, right?
For several nights, yes.
And what happened?
Nothing. It just kept coming back for more.
So Don moved on to his second scheme.
Interceptor, which is a dog heartworm pill, which we also use in the saltwater aquarium world to rid these pests called red bugs that eat coral and kill your coral.
So each night, Don would stuff half a pill inside the shrimp and feed it to the worm.
And what happened when you did that?
Nothing. I did it for 3 nights in a row. And then I waited, and he kept coming back every night.
Could you see him growing bigger as you were feeding him shrimp?
He was getting bolder, which I was also encouraging, like pulling it out a little bit further to see how far. At this point, I didn't know how big he was.
If the worm was long enough, Don was hoping, maybe he could lure it out just far enough to grab it with the tongs and yank it out.
And then I did some reading, and they said if you break it in half, you will have two because it's a segmented worm, so it'll grow a new head.
So that was a no-go, as was tack number two, the deworming pill.
Yeah, the interceptor did not work. So then I got really creative.
On to Don's third plan of attack, feeding the bobbit worm a shrimp filled with super glue.
I thought if it ate it, it would bite into it and glue its mouth closed. So I literally hollowed out a shrimp shell and filled it full of super glue and fed him that.
After the first night, Don thought he had him. The worm ate the super glue shrimp and then disappeared for a couple days. But pretty soon, he was back.
He came back every night. I think it was 4 or 5 times I gave it a try. It still didn't work.
By this time, Don was getting desperate. In addition to his own morbid experiments, he turned to an online aquarium forum for help. And his post generated a ton of interest. They've actually become kind of legendary.
I believe we've named it the Bobbit Worm Chronicles because it went on for so long.
Anyway, Don says, he thinks a lot of the interest was because this was such a new phenomenon, a problem even professional aquariums hadn't cracked yet.
Plus, the thing is just so disgusting. You know, it's like watching a car crash.
And it was a delicate problem to solve. Anything that could kill the bobbit worm could potentially kill Don's other fish. He'd taken a risk with the liquid copper and the interceptor pills. And he couldn't just grab the worm because it was so cautious. It would only come far enough out of the rock to eat and then dart back in the blink of an eye. Don needed something that would physically kill the worm, not just poison it. Everyone on the forum had their own ideas.
Someone on the thread suggested glass, so I ground up glass, mixed it with super glue and put it in there. That didn't work either. I think the second time I fed him shards of glass, like quarter-inch shards of glass. And he did disappear for a few days, actually almost a week, I think. And then I happened to stroll by the aquarium. I thought he was dead, and I saw him out eating one of my corals. So he was back.
At this point, Don was about 3 weeks into his war against the bobbit worm, and he was starting to lose it.
I was traumatized. I was mad, frustrated that I couldn't get the thing out. So I wasn't sleeping at night because I would have to get up at 3 a.m. to feed the thing. And then I was just, very frustrated, extremely frustrated.
This creature posed an existential threat to Don's aquarium. It was decimating his beautiful coral, and he worried that soon it would start eating his fish. Don had been driven to the edge of his sanity. He'd been staying up half the night for weeks, guarding his tank. He'd fed the worm copper, superglue, and broken glass, all with no effect. Clearly, he needed to do something drastic. Go to hand-to-hand combat with the worm.
I finally was like, okay, I'm just going to fish this thing out like it was a fish.
So one night, around feeding time, Don baited a fishing hook with some shrimp and lowered it into the tank.
And he swallowed it whole, and I had him, and it was, I've fished off the Florida Keys. I've had some epic fish battles, but this one went on for, I don't remember. I think it was like 40 minutes.
So it's 2:30 in the morning, and Don is standing on top of his tank in his garage, trying to pull this thing out. At the time, Don had speculated that the worm was maybe 2 to 3 feet long, but as it kept unfurling, this segmented beast covered in dozens of legs, he realized it had reached horrifying proportions.
And every time I pulled it, it would come out a little bit, and it just kept coming out. It was kind of disgusting.
It was strong, but Don was stronger. And then it happened. The bobbit worm snapped. Don stumbled backwards. He watched with horror as the remaining section of the worm darted back into its rock.
And I was left with a 2-foot section of brown grossness.
So was that first section still alive?
It was wiggling around on the floor, yes. I just bagged it up and threw it away.
The worst part? Somehow, Don had ended up with the back end of the worm.
I looked at it and I was like, oh, there's no head. How did I catch the back end?
Knowing what he knew about bobbit worms' ability to regenerate, Don was sure the worm would soon be back to its old tricks. So he kept watch. A day went by, then another, and another. A week, 10 days, no bobbit worm. Maybe it really had died. Don was just starting to relax, just starting to accept that maybe this whole hellish journey was finally over, when he spotted him.
I saw him in the middle of the night eating a very beautiful bright blue sponge that I had.
Don watched with rage as the worm chomped away at his sponge. But then something lucky happened. The worm left his usual hideout, the giant rock, and crawled into a smaller one. Don knew this was his chance. Maybe his only chance.
And I pulled that rock out, dragged it out of my driveway at 3 o'clock in the morning and started busting it up. First, I tried spraying hot water inside its hole to see if it would come out. It did not. So I picked up the rock and broke it. And then it came crawling out, all 5 feet of it.
5 feet. And remember, Don had already snapped off another 2 feet of this thing.
Did you scream?
I believe I swore and then was jumping for joy and trying to take videos of the thing.
You'd think, after everything the bobbit worm put Don through, he'd want to destroy it right away. But he didn't. Instead, he chucked it in a bucket full of water, and the next day called a friend who worked at the local pet store. The friend told Don to bring it in.
So when you finally got it out, did you feel any connection at all to the bobbit worm? You'd been through so much together, you know?
Oddly enough, there was a little bit of me that was like, wow, a little bit, maybe. Maybe. I guess maybe that's why I didn't kill it right away. Plus, I didn't know how to kill it, to be honest. I mean, this thing had just survived everything I could think of.
The worm lived for a while on display at the pet shop, a warning to other aquarium owners of what might be lurking in their tanks.
I did go look at it a few times, yes. He didn't recognize me. But the weird thing was, so this thing is 5 feet long at this point, and they put it in a little tank with these little rocks, maybe 3 inches, 4 inches And that thing would hide in those rocks. Like, I don't know how it did it. They're an amazing creature, that's all I can say. They will be around long after us.
But the worm didn't end up staying a de facto pet. In the end, they put him in a jar of formaldehyde and gave him to a local biology student. And Don's aquarium has been fine ever since. All that's left of his encounter is the forum thread, which gets shared around every few months. And Don's memories of his epic war with a creature from the deep.
This was a battle, but I won.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, the quest to find hidden treasures that have sunk to the ocean floor.
It sank off the coast of Sumatra, modern-day Indonesia, and it's still believed to be carrying more than $1.5 billion, with a B, dollars in gold. Many people have looked for it, but it's never been found.
That's next on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the deep sea and what we're discovering about life in those dark and mysterious ecosystems. Scientists exploring the bottom of the ocean often come upon never-before-seen creatures, but they also find something else.
Almost invariably, on every single dive we do, on every single research expedition, the first thing we find is trash.
That's marine biologist Andrew Thaler, and he says you often find soda cans or even empty cans of Spam that have ended up traveling all the way to the ocean floor.
And so despite the fact that we have this kind of idea of ecosystems that still remain untouched, where there's still tons to discover, we're still impacting them pretty tremendously already.
So there's trash at the bottom of the ocean, but also treasures. For example, from shipwrecks, thousands and thousands of them that have sunk over the centuries.
From all eras of human civilization, human travel, and transport of goods, you could imagine how many ships once sailed over the oceans and how many of them didn't make it where they were going and wrecked.
That's Daniel Stone. He's a senior editor for National Geographic and the author of Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Daniel has been fascinated with stories of shipwrecks since he was a kid.
These are all filled with mystery and intrigue and stories of valor and cowardice. And they grabbed me.
One of the things that Daniel learned about shipwrecks is that most of them break down and disappear within a few years.
The two most corrosive forces on the planet are sunlight and salt water. And so when a wreck goes down in shallow water, it could be gone within a couple of years, and usually is. There are places on the planet where wrecks can be preserved a lot longer. The best one is in the Black Sea, in the middle of Europe and Asia. Big, kind of fresh, half saltwater lake, very deep, low salinity, very low light. And that's why archaeologists look there for the oldest wrecks on Earth, which could be 2,000 to 4,000-year-old Greek and Roman era wrecks that are very well preserved, almost the same condition as the day that they sank.
That's incredible. I mean, to think that they would last that long?
Yeah, even more so that they're wood. I mean, they're organic material. They're not made out of steel. These are wood with wood carvings and photographs taken down there with, you know, these submersible craft with big floodlights show that the wood carvings from 2000 years ago are still in pristine condition. I mean, anyone who knows, like me, who's kind of built a deck or anything out of wood outside knows that you have very little time before it starts to break down. So the Black Sea really is one of the best environments for preservation on Earth.
Daniel says there are three types of people who search for shipwrecks. Scientists who are interested in history and ancient civilizations, others who want to find famous wrecks like the Titanic or the Endurance, and then there are people who are chasing the gold.
These are treasure hunters who are investors, or in some ways just kind of hotshots who think that they might have what other people looking for wrecks didn't have and find maybe a big payday. There are a few hot spots of wrecks with treasure all over the world. One of the main ones is off the coast of Florida and South Carolina. It's called the Treasure Coast, where a lot of Spanish ships back about 500 years ago would carry gold back from South America back to Spain. And a lot of them didn't make it. They would run into storms, and there's a lot of wrecks that sank, galleons with gold on board. The most famous was found in the 70s. It's called the Atocha. It was found with more than $300 million of gold on board. That's the most valuable wreck found ever. But there are wrecks still unfound that are even more valuable. And the most is one called the Flor de la Mar. That was a Portuguese sailing ship, merchant ship, that was sailing from Portugal's colonies in the Indian Ocean around Malaysia and Indonesia. And around the same time, I believe in 1511, it was sailing back and ran into a storm. It sank off the coast of Sumatra, modern-day Indonesia, and it's still believed to be carrying more than $1.5 billion, with a B, dollars in gold. Many people have looked for it, but it's never been found.
When people go out to find these wrecks, what are some of the challenges? How do you begin that quest?
Well, finding wrecks is very difficult, as you'd imagine. It takes, you know, fancy equipment. It takes a lot of time, certainly a good search boat, and the fortune of good weather. I mean, that's the basic formula of what it's required. But I talk to a lot of people who look for wrecks, and a few people who find them, and they've made careers out of going out and finding wrecks. And what they all said was that, you know, before you get to all the expensive stuff that most people don't have access to, the first stage is the research, and that anyone can do in their house, in their home. And that, they clarify, means to dig into the story of a ship and what happened in its final moments, how it was built, how it was operated, who was operating it, and any accounts of eyewitnesses. Often, people who find wrecks say that in that research phase, they find some detail. They'll find some eyewitness mentioning that it was a full moon that night, for example. And so that, you know, leads you to a question of what were the tides like? Where was the water? And those details alone can open up a brand new search area that eventually leads them to the ship.
Once you have, let's say, the rough location where you suspect this shipwreck is, what's the next step? How do you get down there and sort of get eyeballs on the seafloor?
It is very difficult to see underwater, and I say that in a visual sense. We do not have, even still, maps of the seafloor, even remotely as good as the maps we have of the surface of Mars, right? It's much easier to map other planets than it is the bottom of our oceans. And the reason why is that the radio waves that we use to make land maps that hit the land and bounce back, they don't work in water. They don't travel and bounce back. So the only way to see underwater is actually with sound. It's to hear underwater. And so it requires a sonar rig that essentially gets dragged over the surface of the sea floor, maybe about 30, 40 feet up, sends these sound waves down and times their return. This is very laborious. It takes a lot of time. And so to go find lost wrecks, and consider the Titanic in this example. The Titanic is more than 2 miles deep, so dark and so much pressure, you can't go down and see it. You have to effectively hear it through sonar. And this is why the Titanic was lost for more than 70 years before it was found in the mid-1980s, that ships would have to pull sonar rigs on giant cables more than 4 miles long, over the seafloor, and then make wide U-turns and go back and forth and back and forth. They call this mowing the lawn. or doing transects over a search site, and even a fairly defined search site like the Titanic, you know generally where it went down, you know its final coordinates, it still took decades to find it. And it was only now, we know, with the help of military created technology, that the man who found it, Bob Ballard, in the 1980s, was able to find it.
Could you be picking up something else when you're hearing something come up on the sonar? Could it be a giant rock or some other thing that's down there?
Yes, and it usually is. finding a wreck is very difficult because there's all sorts of materials, terrains, topography on the seafloor. In my book, I chronicle a number of people who went to look for the Titanic in the 1970s and 80s, and they did this process with the sonar and the transects, and several times in several spots, they thought they spotted a propeller or a part of the hull or an old boiler, and every time it was just the slope of a canyon or a rock outcrop that was the same shape.
Once you locate a wreck, and it actually is a real wreck, you still have to bring either the whole thing or some of it up to the surface.
It's very rare to pull a wreck up in its entirety. Mm-hmm. It's very laborious, very difficult, and can really only be done in shallow water. One of the most famous wreck salvage operations ever done was the USS Maine, right? Remember the Maine, that ship that sank in Cuba? It sank in less than 100 feet of water, and it still took engineers more than 3 years to figure out a way to salvage it, to pull it up and repair it and effectively sink it in deeper water. But with other wrecks, yeah, you would never be able to pull the Titanic up. I mean, it would be like more technically intensive than trying to land on the moon with what's involved. What usually happens is trying to find pieces or pull up artifacts. And this is done with autonomous underwater vehicles that usually have a robotic arm that can go and pick things out of the wreck or out of the dirt, the mud, the rocks, and pull them up to the surface. This happened with the Titanic with thousands of artifacts of plates and boots and books, picture frames, pieces of furniture that are now usually on display all over the world. But with other wrecks, if you're going down to find maybe $50 million of silver, as happened recently with a wreck called the SS City of Cairo in the South Atlantic, the way you do that, in the simplest terms, is effectively with a giant claw, right? You think of those carnival games with the claw getting the stuffed animal. It's a similar system. First, you have to find the wreck, and then you have to know exactly where on the wreck all of the silver was stored. And then you send down an elaborate claw system that pulls it up and hopefully gets it all to the surface.
Right. And hopefully it doesn't all, I'm just picturing a treasure chest opening up and then thousands of coins floating back to the bottom of the ocean. I mean, there are so many things that can go wrong.
Oh, yeah. I mean, things going wrong is kind of the exact job description of a wreck hunter or anyone really who works on boats.
If there's one wreck you would love to find, what would it be?
You know, there's a wreck that captured me almost since boyhood. It's a wreck called the Waratah, and it's often considered Australia's Titanic. It's a very similar story to the Titanic. You know, a ship that was loaded with a lot of, very important rich people. It sank, very slowly. It has never been found. I think the Waratah is a fascinating wreck. I will say that the Flor de la Mar is, the most valuable wreck on Earth. If someone's going to find a $2 billion wreck, I would love it to be me or at least someone I know. I don't think it will be, though.
Daniel Stone is the author of Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Grant Hill. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.